Author of the Week, featuring another great creator of narratives for the human race on Southside Broadcasting and Siren Radio.
Well, it's particularly apt that on a day in which the Netherlands ambassador to NATO has been saying that Europe and the world needs to be prepared for a war against Russia in the next 20 years, that actually we're talking about cyber terrorism and a variety of other bits and pieces. Maybe, as I say, China are going to be our best friends, best buds. We don't know. Let's turn to our author of the week today, who's certainly written about that extensively in terms of the cyber scenario. It's fabulous Patrick Greenwood. Patrick, how are you?
I'm fine. Good morning, Alex. How are you today? Thank you very much for having me today on the show.
Excellent. It's great to connect with you, yourself. You're obviously now officially one of our Californian correspondents.
Thank you. Yes, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here and a very much honor to be on Siren Radio. So thank you for having me.
Well, it's great to see you. And of course, we kept the international theme going because, as we say, we've also got Anna Teodora Koskinol, who's currently in Lincoln, but is originally from Bucharest. Hello, Anna.
Good, Alex. Thank you for having me. And it's a pleasure to meet you, Patrick.
Excellent.
My pleasure, Brian. Thank you.
And in your country, all set for all manner of marvelous things, from North Carolina, of course, it's Jessica Burtis. How are you, Jessica?
Hello. Doing pretty well. Where are you in the U.S. again?
Irvine, California.
Oh, nice. It must be a bit warmer.
Hold on. Nope. No. A little overcast today, but 58 degrees.
Oh, okay.
Well, there you go. Now, Patrick, let's just break down initially your career. You've had a 25-year career in the information technology field, so you're writing very much about what you know. You've traveled to Vietnam, China, Japan, Taiwan, Portugal, etc. And indeed, you're also a very, very keen cyclist, which for a Los Angelino seems to be most unusual. Indeed, yes. A Californian, so perhaps maybe not Los Angeles.
Yes.
Of course, you also drew upon your experience with respect to Sunrise in Saigon and a fascination very much with, it would seem, American-Sino relations, it would seem.
Yes, very much so. So I've had a chance to travel and work in China and Taiwan, also Europe as well. So one of the things I always loved to do when I was traveling was always kind of visualize and take notes and kind of capture the experience. And later on, like years later, I kind of sat down and said, God, I really would like to write about this. I like, there's a story there somewhere. So in the Sunrise in Saigon, there's a lot of stories around my trips to Vietnam and cycling, obviously getting involved in the water business. But one of my really true goals in a personal level was really going after and trying to find the Catholic nuns that helped get the orphans out at the end of the war. That was actually a true life reality that I wanted to experience. And a lot of my writing reflects a little bit of a mix between fiction and nonfiction writing as well. So as people read my books and my blogs, they're sort of going, is this true? Is this not true? And I kind of go, well, that depends on the reader, to be honest with you. But no, I love mixing fiction and nonfiction in my writing.
Well, it's interesting, of course, you mentioned Sunrise in Saigon. And for those of us of a certain vintage, we certainly remember, obviously, the trauma of the Vietnamese War. We look at movies such as The Killing Fields, which very much outlined a number of the challenges and the tragedies that were actually present within that. And of course, where would American television drama like Magnum PI have actually been if it hadn't been for referencing the huge number of Vietnam-related conflicts, the A-Team and so on and so forth? We've kind of moved on now, of course. Vietnam is very much a tourist destination. So in a real sense, is this something whereby you think that no matter how bleak things might appear, there is always some light at the end of the tunnel?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I was there in 2012 and 13 and 14 and absolutely loved the country, loved the people, felt very welcome. It was amazing. I mean, I went there primarily for a cycling event. I was in a bike race from Ho Chi Minh City to the Cambodian border and back. And I just got so in love with the country. Now, I've been wanting to go since I was 11. So I remember the end of the war and all the tragedies that happened. But, you know, where there's tragedy, there's also harmony, right? And Vietnam is filled with harmony. I mean, Google has a huge presence there in Da Nang. So does Microsoft, Cisco. A lot of the tech companies have invested in Vietnam because they are generating tremendous amount of software engineers. And, of course, they're also building artificial intelligence in Vietnam, which is quite fascinating. And part of that actually does play into my next book, which is called The Shores of Okinawa. There is a portion of the book that talks about a hacker group based in Laos and Vietnam that gets involved in the global scheme of things as well. So Vietnam is absolutely becoming a tech hotbed, you know, for not only for employees, but also for companies as well.
Well, that's something, of course, which looking at the trailer to Shores of Okinawa, we see an unspeakable alliance put forth with respect to that. And this whole, in a sense, end game that many people are actually saying, this is it, it's the end of humanity. We hand over to artificial intelligence and we are doomed. Is that something which also influenced your writing and your thoughts in terms of this, what might possibly happen, but hopefully won't?
Well, actually, in Shores of Okinawa, there is a little bit of artificial intelligence in it, but primarily it does really address a really true narrative going on right now. It's China trying to take over Taiwan, and they're doing so through cyber terrorism, not through ships, guns, battle planes, and and bombs. They're doing it through cyber. And what a lot of people don't realize is that we have been at war with Russia, Iran, North Korea, India, Nigeria, South Africa, Argentina, Peru for 20 years with cybersecurity. Hacking is a 24/7 sport. People make billions of dollars stealing from people. When you get an email saying congratulations, you just won the lottery from somebody in Nigeria, it's probably not real. But the actual book itself, I had the opportunity when I was researching and really getting into the gall of cyber terrorism. What I really featured in the book was really hackers against hackers, or hackers choosing sides. We saw that in the early part of the Ukraine war, where the Ukrainian hacking underground immediately mobilized to take on the Russian cyber forces. It's probably the first time in modern warfare that the cyber attack and defense actually took center stage instead of the traditional type of conventional weapons. So I think the future is definitely going to be, we're going to wake up and go, wait a minute, when did we start having a problem in this country? We have had this problem in the country for 20 years. It's been a cyber problem. And I think people are realizing that the cyber problem is fake emails, fake phone calls, deep fake on voice now, where we can emulate people's voices. Or I could take your picture and morph it, make you look, just as handsome as me, but throw honest voice into it and say, here's now a new movie actress, type of thing. So I think deep fake is.
And there was a pregnant pause there, as obviously the technology has obviously sort of impacted Patrick. Hopefully, Patrick will
Voice,
be
nobody
joining us
knows.
very shortly.
And that's really going to be the hack of the moment going on in this year.
You just froze momentarily on us there, Patrick. So we were a bit concerned in case people were actually tuning in and listening to a gap in the whole sort of sequence. As you rightly said, I mean, we can play around and we can do lots of strange and fun things. And obviously, I do like to every so often sort of change a particular avatar structure and literally actually sort of open up a whole new world from that point of view. But I have to say again, it's a little caveat before we bring Jessica and Anna back into the process that to the best of our knowledge, neither Patrick, Anna, Jessica, or myself have actually been replaced by cybernetic life forms at present. But you don't know. Jessica, over to yourself.
I mean, I think this topic is so interesting to discuss because, like you're saying, we cannot exist as much now without being connected to technology in some way, no matter how much we might dislike it. Having an iPhone or an email feels like it's basically a requirement now for everything. So we're definitely in an interesting era, but I think it's interesting that you also connected with the natural parts of other countries by cycling. You must have seen a lot of beautiful landscapes.
Yes, I have very much so. So every country that I've traveled to, I've managed to take my bike with me on the plane. I really truly think that you really don't get to really understand a country until you're actually doing it behind bars, literally behind, doing your thing on a cycle. You see so much. The other thing also about cycling is you'll find that a lot of the countries are very cycle friendly. Many of them are more cycle friendly than they are car friendly. Right, the Netherlands is all about people cycling everywhere, and in the United States we have beautiful cycling. But Vietnam was a great destination because cycling was big, scooters are big, cars are slowly getting big as well. In Portugal, cycling was incredibly beautiful as well. But I really enjoy that part of life, is to get out on two wheels and just kind of keep your head on a swivel and look around and capture things. Plus, I had a GoPro camera mounted on my helmet, so I would video pretty much everything. When I cycled in Beijing, I actually had the GoPro camera mounted on my helmet, and I circled all around Tiananmen Square, all around the Forbidden City, all the way around, and did not get arrested, which was actually
Really?
pretty impressive. So, but yeah, anywhere I have a chance to cycle, I love to video record it as well.
And with natural landscapes and seeing things like that, experiencing a country, I'm guessing it helps you write a lot about the country itself and experiencing it. And I'm also curious, because your book deals so much with technology and cybersecurity, how do you write something that isn't really tangible? And do the audience need to know, get some primers before they jump into your books to understand, or can they just get right in?
I can dive right in. I really try to make it very reader friendly. I don't get too techy because I'm not writing a tech manual. Now, in my real life, I actually do write blogs for technology companies. So I retired from tech in 2022. I was a sales and engineering person, and I decided to write full time. So I write real technical stuff on my real name of John Gormley. On the fictional name, however, I do try to make sure there is a nice blend of technology in my books, but I want to make sure everyone can read it and understand it. I don't want somebody to read and go and then fold up the book because it was too techy. But the other part you mentioned about the landscape, part of the reason I love to cycle is not so much the landscape as it is beautiful, it's the people. When I look back on some of the videos that I recorded, you see people smiling, or people sitting at a cafe, or couples walking hand in hand, or you see street merchants selling, food or things like that. That's the part of the videos that really mean the most to me, is really the essence of the people. And you really don't truly get to know or really see people until you really do it like that. Not doing it from the car or trying to take a picture from the window or whatever. But when you're on a bike and you're looking around and you're seeing all these incredible people, you realize that people really do get along with people very well in this world. It's the governments that hate each other, but the people on people is absolutely very beautiful. And I try to capture that in my book as well.
I love that. I think that's very true and very important now.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Anna, do you think Patrick would benefit from a cycle journey through Bucharest?
So, especially because people from Romania in general, not only Bucharest, are very friendly, and we like people to come and see our country and get rid of that image they have about us, that it's not a good country, it's not a nice country, and that people are basically thieves.
Yeah.
So
Well,
yeah, I do believe that.
so I used to work for a tech company based in Bucharest. I used to work for Bitdefender, and they're headquartered in Bucharest. So I worked for them for about 2 years, and I actually write content for them today. I actually do content writing, but yeah, I worked for them, and a great company, great tech company, very proud Romanian company as well, and they have a U.S. presence here as well. But yeah, I worked for them for about 2 years. I was a sales engineering for Southern California for them. And no, I remember a lot of video calls with people from Bucharest, and it was 5 o'clock here, 4 a.m. there type of calls. But a wonderful, I know the company is very well thought of across all of Bucharest and Romania as well.
For me, it's such a beautiful country, and the people are amazing. And to be honest, hearing people and Romanian people as well talking badly about it makes me so sad, because it really is beautiful. And I think it's the people that make the place special and to give the vibe of the place, rather than only how it looks, because it has everything. You have mountains, you have seaside, you have everything, which is amazing. But the people talking badly about it make more than half of it.
Yes. No, you're a beautiful country. Absolutely
But
beautiful.
I do
Patrick.
have a question for you, if I can. You traveled a lot and you went to many different cultures and you visited so many countries. And my question to you would be, do you feel like the countries that you visited that are more religious and have their roots more into their traditional lifestyles and religion, are the people from those countries more loving or more understanding, rather than the people that, let's say, are not so religious, or they just don't believe in, I don't know, an upper power or something?
Every country I traveled to had a religious culture in some form. Japan, very, very religious, Buddhism. Vietnam, very religious as well. Philippines, a mixture of Catholic and other religions, is Muslim as well. Every country I've never traveled a country that did not have a religious culture in some form. When I was in China and I was living in Beijing for about 2 weeks for work, there was a Roman Catholic cathedral across the street from the Marriott I stayed at, 2 blocks from the Forbidden City. So everywhere you'll find that there is religion in every country, and then there is people that have a true belief, and then there's probably people that don't. But I did not find in any country, even in China, I did not find any form of suppression, you know, at least visually, any suppression of religion. In Italy, of course, very Catholic. In Spain, very Catholic. In Mexico, very, very Catholic as well. In the United States, we have a mixed bag of things as well. Canada, I found I was very religious, even when I was in Switzerland. I was actually in Basel, Switzerland, and they had beautiful churches there as well. So every country I've ever traveled to, ironically, has a very religious culture.
Let's move on, Patrick, if we may, to your latest text, which is going to be released on Memorial Day weekend this year. Yes. That's Shores of Okinawa. Yes. I mean, clearly, as I say, we've had a look at the YouTube trailer, which is wonderful from its own point of view. Let's talk a little bit more about this particular sort of area that's there, because as I said at the start, there are zones where we think, you know, there are connections within this. I mean, we hear obviously the descriptor as he looked across the Detroit River and the Canadian sunset. Jack thought about what to do with his life after deciding not to meet Lynn, his lover from Vietnam. Jack's time watching the sunrise in Saigon with Lynn had become a distant past. He decided to return to Nella, his new girlfriend, and head to Portugal to meet her parents. I mean, you know, is Jack somebody that we sort of see as an anti-hero? Is he somebody who's a James Bond-esque serial womanizer? You know, where do we actually position the sort of characters? Is he an alter ego of Patrick Greenwood?
No, thank God. But I would say Jack very much is, I wouldn't want to put him in the context of a reluctant hero. But I do think that he's like any other human being. He has positive sides to him. He has flaws. And I think one of the reasons I really crafted his character was I really wanted him to show his vulnerabilities, but I also wanted to show that he does have a tremendous caring for people, and more importantly, caring for his children. You know, William and Regina that are in the book, you know, go on and have tremendous lives. So it really kind of shows his personal father side of it. But at the same time, it also shows that, you know, what is he all about? He's a global troubleshooter. He knows how to take on the bad guys. Forrest Adams, which is another major character in the book, is, you know, has been kind of his, you know, shadow or kind of his big brother for quite many years. He's another character that has a tremendous strength in the book. But this really is about showing like a really true to life character. Now, Jack has got 6 books coming in the series. So this is book number 2. It does have a little bit to tie back to Sunrise in Saigon, but not very much. Honestly, it's more of the introduction of Travis Jones, who's his nemesis at the end of the first book. This is really carries it forward to say, now what is Travis up to? Now Travis' true intent is to work with China to hack Taiwan, and he needs, you know, Bitcoin to be able to do that. So it does have a lot of the modern narratives of stealing Bitcoin and hacking countries and hackers hacking hackers and things like that. But at the center of this, it really is about Jack struggling as a person to say, I've lost this one, you know, person. I want to make a life with Nala, but the part of the story that gets to be more dramatic is what happens to Nala. And a lot of it has to go back to, did Jack cause this by stealing the project back in the first book? So there's some ties back to book one, but not very many, but Jack is a very strong character. Regina, his daughter, is a very strong, badass girl who does tremendous things. And there's other strong characters as well, but Jack really is shows a lot of vulnerability, but he also shows a lot of strength as well.
And you mentioned, of course, Regina there. Of course, the one person you haven't mentioned as yet is the head of China's People's Liberation Army, the PLA Cybersecurity Forces, General Vo, which, again, I was thinking that's very Bond-esque in terms of the title, etc. And again, very synchronicity-based because we just heard that Vladimir Putin has relaunched SMERSH, Soviet agency that was designed to kill all spies. I mean, are we heading into another Cold War with the cybersecurity? Or, as you said earlier, we've actually been in that war for the last 22 decades and not realized it.
We have been in it for the last decades. I think that's the one thing I hope that the book does, is it raises awareness saying, you know, did cyber terrorism between China and the US just happen, or did it just start? Has China been hacking Taiwan? Has Vietnam been hacking Taiwan? And why suddenly are these global hackers, which are people that steal billions of dollars, suddenly taking alliances? Why is one hacker group going with China and the other going with Japan? And it's interesting how it takes the part of the book goes all the way up to the prime minister of Japan, who says, I know my guys help. He's referring to the Yakuza. He's referring to the mob. And the Chinese are saying, yeah, but we're partnering with the triad. So now you have governments partnering with criminals who are partnering with hackers to say, we need to mobilize. So I think it kind of takes a little bit of the shred of the Ukraine war a little bit, where you had this underground army that was existing for years who suddenly came to the defense of their own country. So I think the book kind of has a little bit of that flavor as well. But no, I think people after reading the book hopefully will go, so this has been going on for a lot of years. Not just, it's not a recent a phenomenon. It's been happening for years.
Jessica.
I mean, I'm very interested in this book specific. I mean, it has a personal tie for me because my grandfather was stationed in the army as a secretary and a guard for a couple years in Okinawa. And I have a friend whose brother is currently stationed in Okinawa. So I feel like it's a really cool connection. It makes me, I know my dad will be very interested in this. So I'll definitely have to mention it. But I also think this is just interesting hearing about the relationship between the US and Russia, and I feel like those two tend to go head to head quite a lot with the
We've got
cybersecurity. But
history, perhaps.
yeah, a little bit, you know. There was actually a couple years ago in a town near me when we were there for the summer, the gasoline was just completely turned off because a Russian group in Russia had just messed with the pipes for fun and shut off the gas. So it's very interesting how these books really do tie into real life quite a lot.
Well, Columbia, yeah, it was a Columbia pipeline you're talking about, and there was a ransom
Yes.
attack. Yeah. So that was just another example where our utility, it does shows how exposed our utilities are in America. I mean, our power grid has been hacked, our banks get hacked. I was a global account manager years ago for Wells Fargo. And believe me, they have, just like everybody else in Disney and all the others, have cyber security defensive systems for a reason, you know, because they're being targeted constantly. So healthcare, how many times you read medical records are stolen from healthcare providers? I mean, it is really shows the susceptibleness of this stuff. The information is worth billions. I mean, that they hackers will steal 100,000 medical records and put it up on the dark web. And within an hours, people are paying $250 per medical record. They want to know what pills you take. They want to know what, you know, are you cancer? Are you diabetic? Are you heart, you know, things like that. That's all valuable information. We're just a little slow at spending the money necessary to protect. And that's another part of the book that I really kind of harped on, is that because this is constantly ongoing, it constantly changes. What we're protecting today will be different tomorrow. That's the fear of artificial intelligence, because artificial intelligence is not about just processing data and coming up with cool ideas. Hackers use AI to hack people, and AI tells them, this is how you should write that email. This is how you should approach that person in public. Here's how you should steal the video surveillance from their Ring, from their home, and use that information to be able to manipulate that. And they can do that now in seconds. So what used to take days to come up with a hack, with AI, they can come up with a hack in seconds. So that shows how vulnerable our society has become. The more open we are, the more likely that we're going to get hacked. Russia knows this. China knows this. Iran knows this. North Korea knows this. Nigeria knows this, right? They send emails to elderly people in retirement homes saying, hey, I know we haven't talked in a while, but can you send me money so I can come visit you? And people actually, oh, yes, of course. And they wire money to a bank account in Africa. They have no idea. And that happens every day. So I'm hoping that the book raises awareness more. I hope people realize that it's not some fluke that you got an email or your credit card got jacked. But it is, I hopefully does take some time and help people know that this stuff's ongoing.
Yeah,
You
it's
raise
definitely a bit scary to hear about, but it's good to think about, I think, because all of us are affected.
Yes, very much so.
And you raise a really interesting point though, Patrick, in terms of yeah, I can recall those Nigerian relative emails, and you know, you'd have to be pretty down the line of intelligence start to sort of suss that this was a fake scenario. However, they have become much more sophisticated.
Yes, I have.
Requests from your bank, from various reputable agencies, respect, and it's one of the reasons, certainly at the University of Lincoln, the home of Siren Radio, we do monthly tests, cybersecurity tests, etc. And it is one of those areas where, as you said, there's a kind of sort of notion that for the ease and the facility and all the good stuff that we've actually got out of the web, etc., there's a huge area which means one has to be extraordinarily careful in terms of what's going on. Let's turn once again to Anna. Anna, any thoughts from yourself about this, or indeed the upcoming book?
When talking about raising awareness to people, I was just thinking that some people, they're not open to this kind of information and they get very defensive when hearing this. And I don't know why, because it's maybe because they are, as you said it nicely, tied down on the intelligence level, or just because they're afraid, but they are not very open to hearing things like this, and they get triggered. And I was thinking, if you think, do you think people are prepared to hear these type of things? Do you think they are taking it on well, or do you think they need just a couple of more years or a longer time with things happening around them just so they can be exposed to them and start realizing this is real, this is going on. We should start listening to other people that have an idea about what's going on.
Well, one of the things that's a great question on it, because one of the things that really is happening today, and Alex, I think you kind of hinted on this, people have already been hacked today. They just don't know it. People are getting emails, people are getting impersonation attacks, people are getting phone calls, people are getting texts from mysterious people. They said, "Oh, hey, been a while," type of stuff. That happens every day. So there's not a person in the world that probably has not experienced some level of a cyber hack in some form. They just didn't realize. Did they lose money? Are they copying data off your laptop? Do they hack your watch? All that stuff is happening real. In the book, in Shores of Okinawa, there's a portion of the book I talk about the Internet of Things network in Taiwan, how the hackers go in and they basically start controlling every street light, every medical device, every single bank transaction, because we've made it convenient for us to bank on our tablets, right? Well, the reality is, yes, we've made it convenient to bank on our tablets. However, it's opened up a huge, cybersecurity problem. So people are starting to discover, like, why is my password not working? Well, because somebody found a way to crack your password. But I do think people today are open because they realize they want answers. They're like, well, what happened? Why did I get this? Why am I getting something in the mail that says I just signed up for a credit card? Well, I didn't do that. It all starts back to some form of a cyber event. And I do emphasize that in the book. I try to bring people in the book along a bit of a journey of why does Taiwan want to do this to Taiwan? They don't want to fire bullets. They don't want to fire missiles. But if they do it through cyber, they can sneakily get in and get out and do their thing, but they need help. So they go to global hackers. They go to terrorists and they say, hey, we need you. We have to hire you. Today, there's a process where people actually go out and hire hackers called ransomware for hire. And they bring them in and say, I need you to go after this group of people. And they pay them for that. And it's sort of like almost like a commerce. Hacking groups have payroll. They probably even have medical. Who knows? But the reality, though, is that people now that aren't used to cybersecurity are reading in the magazines, newspapers, watching the news, and reading books, going, I want to know more. So I think people are thirsty for information, to be honest with you, about cybersecurity.
Britain and the United States this year are likely to have full elections. We could, by the time we get together in January 2025, actually have Donald Trump back in the White House and Boris Johnson and Nigel Farage back in the UK if things actually really took a turn for the unexpected. But is that something where, in terms of politics and general elections, I mean, we're hearing certainly in the UK that this will be the first major cyber fought election.
Yes.
And clearly, we had lots of scenarios back in the States over 2016, 2020, etc. About that. Is that something which the legit authorities are aware of, or is it a case of it's a shrug of the shoulders and fingers crossed?
I think really, I think the Supreme Court is already starting to weigh in on voting booths, voting machines, people showing up at a voting area without ID. These are all things that when you look at the political spectrum in America, you have people on one side that say, no, you can just show up and vote because we want you to be free. Well, the problem is, how many times do people show up and vote? Once, twice, three times, there's no accountability. The other side says ID, passport required. So just a simple decision like that can cause an election fraud. And then you take it up a notch where now you have digital machines that have a back-end modem plugged into it, which nobody explained why there was a modem plugged into a voting machine during an election. That should have been unplugged. Why was it plugged in? Right. So little things like that happened in the last election. I think the bigger problem in this one going into 2024 is going to be the misinformation. People are not going to know the difference between Donald Trump being an awesome dude and President Biden, really, he's really 64, not 88 or however old it is. And all that misinformation through email, through texting, through YouTube videos, it's all going to be misinformation. The moment they can emulate people's voices, that is an absolute game changer for voter fraud. Because now you have people going, "Hi, this is Donald Trump. Please vote for me." That's not him. That's somebody who's simulated his voice. So I think this is going to be a very difficult election, not only at the federal level, but at the state level, because now you're going to see mayors, district attorneys, local congresspeople, city council people all being affected by misinformation, and we don't have an answer for it. No, there's no, I mean, we can't, we don't technically censor in the United States, so we don't have policies on censoring. We don't have a policy for privacy in the United States like you do in the EU, where you do have GDPR and other
Well,
privacy
I
regulations.
mean, we're no longer part of the EU, obviously, in Britain, but that's another line entirely. Best not go there because that's a whole other issue.
Oh, absolutely. But you have privacy laws in the UK, and we don't. We don't have a national privacy law in the United States yet. So it means that we're not prepared to protect my information that could be used for, hey, I just took Patrick Greenwood's name and now he's voted in Iowa. Well, I never been to Iowa. I mean, so this is a very challenging year, and I think this is going to be a cyber election. This is going to be a cyber attack election. And it's going to take 6 months in courts to sort it out in 2025. It's not going to be, "Hey, he won on election night and begin the party." I think it's going to run into, "Well, how do we know he won, or how do we know he lost, or she won?" We may not know that for 6 months after the election, because there may be so much problems with people potentially electronically manipulating the votes. So yeah, I think this is going to be a hell of a year to watch an election for sure.
Makes one almost hanker for the days of Chads in Florida and Al Gore, but still, that's another story.
Oh yeah.
Jessica, let's throw in a slightly more surreal question, and it's your nutrition question, which I know you're keen to find out Patrick's response to. Go.
Yes. So I would love to know if you've ever tried some regional food from where I'm from, specifically the wonders of sweet tea or boiled peanuts.
Sweet tea, I can't because I have to watch my sugar. I'm a little bit older in life, so I got to be chilled on that. I have done boiled peanuts, of course. I love pho in Vietnam. Of course, you have it in America, but having a pho in Vietnam is very special as well. I love grouper in Portugal. I thought the way that they cooked their grouper was fantastic as well. Obviously, Italy, I put on way too much weight eating Italian food in five different cities. But I'm really a huge connoisseur of coffee and espresso. So I actually have a coffee company called CycleRider3Espresso.com, and the proceeds of all my coffees and my hoodies and so on all go to help charities. So in the first book, everything I sold and coffee from everything else went to Helmets for Kids in Vietnam. It was a nonprofit organization that helped provide kids with helmets. So when I was there, I witnessed a lot of children getting sideswiped by scooters, and none of them were wearing helmets. So I got involved in that organization to help raise some money. Turned out that Michelle Yeoh, the actress, was actually the global ambassador for it. I didn't know until sometime later that she was involved in it. But that was a wonderful charity to work for. In this book, in Shorts of Okinawa, HelpOki.org is a nonprofit that is trying to end poverty in Okinawa as well. So that's my benefactor of my second book. Every book I write has a benefactor to that. When I've had a chance to be in Okinawa recently, I was actually stationed there back in the 80s, so I got to go back this very recently with my son and run around. Any local food. Oh, I mean, I'm a yakisoba junkie. I can eat sushi until I'm blue, but I really like going into some of the really kind of like quiet local areas and try the local cuisines and local foods as well. I had fish oil in Vietnam, which if you've ever tried fish oil, it's kind of a little bit, it's very, very salty. But every country, I'm a big fan of the local coffee. I'm a big fan of local teas. And obviously a big fan of just finding the local food, and I'll eat first and ask questions later. Like, "What is in here?" I don't ask that one. I eat it first and say, "Okay, well, what was that?" And they'll be looking at me going, it kind of look like that. But I'm a huge fan of eating local food everywhere I travel to as well.
That's awesome. It's such a great way to experience just the humanness of wherever you are is what people love to have. And I'm very impressed you've had boiled peanuts. You're one of the very few that has ever said yes to
Yes,
that. So it's nice
absolutely
to
love it.
hear.
Yes, absolutely love
And it also ties in with Michelle Yeoh, who, of course, was the character Wei Lin in the Bond movie Tomorrow Never Dies, recently featured on another program, Residents Rewind. I think that's to be fair, as Jessica just said, Patrick, that's probably one of the most extensive responses we've actually had to the nutrition question, which is very good indeed. So before we actually head off to the final two questions, how can people actually follow yourself through the social media for the real Patrick Greenwood and so on?
Well, first of all, the best place to go is psychowriterllc.com is my author's website. That has all of my synopsis of my books as well. It also keeps people updated on what's going on as far as my book tours and things like that as well. For this specific book, Shores of Okinawa novel.net is where I'm hosting the book. And more importantly, the movie trailer is on that as well, as you mentioned. When I do release the book on Memorial Day weekend, 2024, I'll be having social media links going out on Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn. So Patrick Greenwood is everywhere and everywhere. I do have a Facebook page for Shores of Okinawa. And of course, I do have a LinkedIn page for Patrick Greenwood as well.
And we'll be speaking to futurist Andrew Grill in a few moments' time. But before then, we have two critical questions for you, Patrick. Jessica, would you like to deliver the first, please?
I would love to. Patrick, have you had a reasonably interesting Zoomer with us today?
Yes.
Nice. Took time. A little bit worried there. Building attention, you know, it's very good here. Yeah. Very reflective routine. And Anna, the next question.
When can you join us again?
Yes, will you be kind enough to return sometime in the near future?
I would love to be back on your show. I'd love to be back right around, probably if we can do right before the launch in May, I would love to have you on. I'm going to have more updated content by then. The book will be obviously ready to release on Memorial Day weekend, but I'll be definitely doing a media tour probably around the April timeframe. But I would love to be on your show again. This is a wonderful podcast and you all ask wonderful, wonderful questions. So thank you.
Well, Patrick, it's been awesome connecting with you, good sir. Thanks obviously to Jessica and to Anna. Keep on keeping on. And yes, beware those cyber criminals. Clearly, that's the message.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Well, we've talked a lot about AI, of course. What about AR, augmented reality? What about 5G? What about wearables? What about the future? Well, somebody who can actually talk very much about the future with a fair degree of success is, of course, futurist and indeed expert AI speaker and indeed podcast host, Andrew Grill. How are you, Andrew?
Alex, how are you? Good to talk to you.
Well, great to connect with your good self, of course. I want to just put a little caveat at the start of this that neither Andrew nor myself, as far as I'm aware, have been replaced as yet by AI or indeed artificial intelligence. So we are real life human beings.
We are. I'm actually writing a book at the moment. And the first chapter, the first sentence says, this book has been written by a human. I thought I better also make that point.
It is something. I mean, we have to do it with our students. They have to kind of make a declaration that it's original work with dissertations. And we are in that field where an awful lot of folk would say, well, on the one hand, we've got this utopian vision of the future in which everything is done for us. We've got everything sorted out in sports. We don't have to worry about VAR because the technology is in the whole environment that's actually there. Is it all going to be good in the next few years?
Well, VAR is a really interesting one. And it's a hot topic. And working with Vodafone UK, I've actually looked at and I predicted five ways that this new 5G technology, 5G standalone, will transform the UK. And you know, when we think about sports and football and VAR, what I think we'll see in the near future is 5G standalone powered chips that are actually in the match balls. They're in players' boots. They're on the pitches. We'll also have multiple camera angles. I'm not sure about you if you've ever tried to connect to the Wi-Fi and share your experience from a stadium, but 5G standalone will actually allow multiple people to connect. It could then actually enable you to mix your own version of the game from all the camera angles and send that off to your friends. The whole VAR thing will be a thing of the past because we'll have all the information at our fingertips. There'll be AI there with all these different views. And it'll just be instant. Was it a try? Was it a goal? Did they score? Were they offside? We'll know instantly in the stadium what happened.
Isn't that going to affect and impact one of the key joys of sport, though? It's innate controversy where people can actually blame the referee and so on. I mean, if the computer is actually saying no, doesn't that take away from the challenges and the fun?
Well, I don't think so. I like to think that technology can enhance your life. The fact that we have mobile phones, you talked about AI. I'm the glass half full. In fact, I'm the glass is overflowing. I think technology is a wonderful thing, but it's wonderful when it can be used to help business and society. So, you know, you think years ago before this VAR, before this Hawkeye in tennis technology was there, we relied on a human being being perfect, and we know that they're not. I think if we can augment and supplement that, it'll be a fairer game because I'm sure there's some even VAR decisions that we disagree with. We'd like to have all the information at our fingertips. Imagine all 50,000 people in the stadium having the same information as the former VAR referee, being able to say, yep, that definitely was a goal, that was a try, because I have the information in my hand.
You have, as you noted, been working with Vodafone for this particular survey and 5G. I mean, there are people I'm sure listening to this about think 5G, we barely get 3G, let alone 5G. And clearly, there are areas of the UK in particular that do suffer from a lack of connectivity. But I noticed you were referring to this thing called ultra low latency of 5G standalone. Can you talk further a bit about that?
Yeah, 5G standalone is the pure version of 5G. Existing 5G networks have actually been launched on top of 4G, which means it has to share the connections, the frequencies, the networking there. But 5G standalone, by its very name, mean is it's a standalone network. It has its own network, own control, own frequencies, own technology. It means that the real promise of 5G can be realized, not just faster speeds, lower latency, which means you've got less buffering. Actually, phone battery life can be improved. And more importantly, with that VAR example, 5G allows massive amounts of devices, not just phones, balls, football boots, to be connected at the same time. But importantly, the things that we love, like sports, will only be transformed with 5G standalone if a national network is rolled out. And that will require some investment.
Now, you talked about things that we love there. That brings us neatly round to reality TV shows such as Love Island. And I was fascinated to see that you're also suggesting that viewers can become part of the broadcast. Personally, I can't think of anything worse than actually being a virtual part of Love Island. But is this something which you think, yeah, that embedding, that immersive technology, that augmented reality, if you wish to actually be on the bridge of the Starship Enterprise, living your best life with Picard or Kirk and so on, you could possibly do that?
Well, the technology is getting better and better, and certainly AI. I mean, I've been playing with AI voice. I've got an AI voice clone, so if I want to re-record something, I can use that. Video technology is there. Some years ago, there was the Black Mirror episode called Bandersnatch, which used existing technology to look at various endings, and you could choose your own endings. But you mentioned Love Island, and we've got the Love Island All-Stars on at the moment. I think with 5G standalone, viewers will become producers. And it'll become a real immersive experience. It might be that the producer can say, okay, we will now want to go to the audience. Who do you think should couple up? And maybe you could have virtual couple ups where AI could actually show what it would be like if contestant A and contestant B were actually coupled up. Now, I think that's something that could be a stretch for some people, but I think also it will add another element to these reality TVs. We've all got used to reality TV. We know that initially it wasn't real, now it's scripted in a way. Imagine if the end user, the audience, could choose the end of the show. That I think would be amazing.
Well, it certainly provides nightmare scenarios for Charlie Brooker and his team for Black Mirror to continue to write about. Obviously, very skeptical is dear old Charlie, and we can understand why. Let's talk about wearables. This aspect that, in essence, the augmented ways in which we take on board Bluetooth connections, etc. I mean, I've heard over the last few years people talk about beauty about wearables is they can be very sustaining from an energy point of view because our movement will effectively charge up the technology.
Yeah, there's been some technology for a while. If you walk over a specific pavement, it actually charges up and devises energy. But one of the other trends I looked at, the second big trend, will be talking trainers and chatty cardigans. You're probably used to what we call RFID, radio frequency identity tags. If you tap into your office or your Oyster card, that's an example of RFID. Imagine marrying that with 5G standalone, where you can have these massive amounts of connections. So we could actually have the garments talking to each other. I might have set up on my app that I'm looking for a new look. And so as I walk down the street, the devices are actually talking to me, saying, this is the latest trend. And I can actually look at that. I can then use my AI assistant to look at giving me a new look. So I think we're going to see more of that. I think other retail experiences will be enhanced. At the moment, if you go to an Amazon Go store, you can walk out without actually having to go to a till. I don't know about you, but even the self-checkout, I have to find the barcode and find out how to scan it properly. With 5G standalone and having these 5G enabled chips in everything, we may have frictionless shopping finally. And I don't know about you, but that's something I'm very much looking forward to.
And maybe it's my innate skepticism, but given the freezing cold temperatures we were having recently in Lincoln, just actually getting my pass card to actually allow the door to actually open up before 7 a.m. was problematic. But that's another issue. It would have been a lot easier when we just used to have keys and such like stuff. I'm not a Luddite, but it's just, things can go wrong. Okay, how can people find out more about your own work, Andrew, and indeed this Vodafone research?
Well, the Vodafone research and the Vodafone 5G standalone network, it all comes about because what Vodafone are looking to do is to merge with Three and actually have a fantastic nationwide 5G standalone network. There's a special website that's been set up where listeners can find out more about what Vodafone and Three are doing at vodafoneand3.uk. That's vodafoneand3.uk. And also you can access some of the research from my report.
And for people who wish to access your own podcast as the Actionable Futurist, where would you point them?
Just Google the Actionable Futurist. There's just one of me.
Well, indeed, sir. Presumably, there obviously needs to be a kind of series in which we'd have the less actionable futurist and the somewhat kind of a more technically skeptical futurist, if that's not a contradiction in
Well,
terms.
I'd love to have you on my show, and I love the skeptics because I like being proven wrong. I like playing with technology and seeing how it can help people.
Andrew, it's been awesome connecting with your good self through the technology of Zoom. Who would have thought that would have been a matter of case and sort of usefulness pre-pandemic? But expert AI speaker and podcast host, Andrew, many thanks indeed. Take care now.
Thanks, Alex.
Technology and humanity, and humanity and technology. It's clearly a case that over the last few millennia, as new technologies come into place, people have always panicked. There've been Luddites who said, "No, it'll take our jobs away for us." We've had saboteurs who'd be concerned about a whole variety of other bits and pieces. Maybe a similar thing's happening with AI and robotics, because as our next two guests will address, it may well be a case of there will be more jobs available rather than fewer jobs from that perspective. And to talk us through that, we're delighted to welcome the Managing Directors of Vocational Qualifications and Training at Pearson. That's Freya Thomas-Monk. How are you, Freya?
Hello, good morning. I'm doing very well, thank you.
Excellent. We've also got the President of the Association of Colleges, Corianne Peasgood. How are you, Corianne?
I'm very well, thank you.
Brilliant. Let's turn to Freya, if we may. Were you surprised by this finding? I mean, by 2027, the East Midlands workforce apparently will have another 17,700 more jobs for local people.
I wasn't surprised, but I was rather pleased when I was looking at the data for the local area. I'm excited by what I see. You're absolutely right. We do see a net increase over the course of the next 5 years in the West East Midlands area, but that mirrors what we see across England. So, particular industries I'm really interested in. You see information and communication, so that's the IT industry. Not a surprise, but we're going to see growth in your local area. Transportation and storage around logistics. Again, we're going to see growth. And I think that's such a great opportunity for lots of different people working in the area to really think about how their roles might change. At the same time, we certainly do see some industries which are going to change and perhaps decline in the number of roles. Retail, some parts of manufacturing, some parts of financial and insurance. We do see some of those declining. But the good news on this is that all of the skills that lots of people have today, the transferable skills around customer service, teamwork, communication, they're going to be as needed in the future as they are today in the new roles.
Well, I can confirm that neither Freya nor Corianne nor myself are indeed artificial life forms at present. But Corianne, just turning to your good self in terms of those soft skills, those communication skills, etc., are they things that effectively you would echo Freya's lines there that, yeah, we will need that. We still need that human experience?
I think they're absolutely critical, and particularly looking forward with artificial intelligence and how it changes the way that we work, yes. And I think learning those skills and making sure we have them right from school all the way through lifelong learning is really important. And then sitting alongside that is the technical skills that people will need for various industries as the roles and sectors grow. And as you said at the beginning, this isn't new. We've seen changes, throughout time, and there are jobs in history, if we look back, that don't exist anymore. But I think the balance of that and the speed of change is greater now. So it's great to have this Pearson research so that we can really see what is needed in terms of the technical and those transferable skills over the next few years.
Right, you've had over 20 years' experience in the UK in international high-profile businesses. There's been an awful lot of rhetoric that's been churned out over the years in terms of how we're coping with AI. It's been particularly interesting, I think, the last 12 months. AI has very much come to the fore here. I mean, obviously, science fiction fans were well aware of it long before the current vogue. But is that something where that panic, that sense that actually, you know, oh, it's going to take our jobs away, we're going to have problems with it, etc., is that something you're having to address as a challenge?
I think it's a new tool that everyone needs to figure out how they're going to use going forward. And it's so wide ranging. Now, what I'm excited by is the application of AI that enables us to see a little further into the future in terms of roles and skills that will be needed. So the changing in the workforce is not a new phenomenon. It's been going on, as Corianne has said. But what this data enables us to do is to really think and plan ahead in a way that we haven't been able to do before. And that's because AI really enables us to crunch huge data sets of information around the world in a way that is unique and unprecedented in what we've been able to do. So that's really exciting. How we use AI as a day-to-day as individuals, well, that's another thing. I'm certainly getting to grips with it within my current role, which I'm enjoying doing. But I just on an in, just my own personal experiences, you really need to apply human skills alongside anything, any enabling you have with AI to get the most out of the job and to get the most out of any tool that you have. So I really look forward to hearing everyone's experiences in terms of doing that in their day-to-day jobs.
Corianne, we've looked at the jobs that are going to be available. I'm intrigued to see that obviously bus and coach drivers in there, also IT and telecommunications professionals, cab drivers, chauffeurs, etc. But those jobs that are actually going, sales and retail assistants, kitchen and catering assistants, food, drink and process operatives, etc., receptionists, were you surprised by any of those particular areas? Because, I mean, I would have thought, in essence, can an AI ever sort of replace the person who's on reception, who effectively is the gatekeeper to the company?
I think if we look at how we are welcomed into companies now and businesses compared to how we were even 5 years ago, it's changed considerably. But I think, as Freya just said, the human skills that are needed behind that electronic interface that we have with companies now are critically important. So it's not just about people having the technical skills to put that AI in place and to replace those roles, but it's having the human and personal skills to make sure that it's the right experience that we have. So the roles will be different, but the functions will still need doing.
And as president of the Association of Colleges, do you feel that in terms of FE and arguably even HE as well, we're prepared for that in Britain? Or is it a case of, well, some are, some aren't, some frankly like to bury their heads in the sand?
I think we really need to take on the fact that the scale of the change over the next few years is going to be bigger than we've seen in the past. And we really need to see government, policymakers, colleges and employers all responding to that now. I think what we need is an overarching skills strategy for the country so that it all sits within that, but then really making sure that we've got local and regional accountability and responsibility for delivering, because it is very different in each area of the country. I think we need to see that young people and adults have a right to lifelong learning, because it's not the case anymore that you can be trained once in your life and you develop your skills as you go through your life. There is extra training needed, and commit to sufficient investment and funding to actually be able to do that.
Freya, finally, from your good self, where can people find more details about Pearson's online Skills Map of England?
Oh, I'm so glad you asked. Pearson.com and look for the Skills Map of England, and any search engine should take you there as well. Hope you enjoy taking a look. You can click through to the different regions. And I completely agree with what Corianne is saying. We need policy, funding and good thinking on a regional by region basis to really support the skills evolution in this country. It is so different region by region, but with an overall trend of there being different, not fewer jobs. And I look forward to working on it in the future.
Freya Thomas Monk, Managing Director of Vocational Qualifications and Training at Pearson, and Corianne Peasgood, President of the Association of Colleges. I'll need to say, wrap up with the classic line, keep on working, folks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Come, my little friends, as we all sing a happy little working song. Merry little voices, clear and strong. Come and roll your sleeves up, so to speak, and pitch in. Cleaning crud up in the kitchen as we sing along. Trill a cheery tune in the tub as you scrub a stubborn mildew stain. Pluck a hairball from the shower drain to the gay refrain of a happy working song. We'll keep singing without fail, otherwise we'd spoil it. all enjoy letting loose with a little la-da-dum-dum-dum. While we're emptying the vacuum, it's such fun to hum a happy working song. Ooh, a happy working song. Oh, how strange a place to be. A happy working tune to hum while you're sponging up the soapy scum. We adore each filthy tour that we determine. So friends, even though you're vermin, we're a happy working dog. Singing as we fetch the detergent box for the smelly shirts and the stinky socks. Sing along. If you cannot sing, then hum along as we're finishing our happy working song. Ah, wasn't this fun?